They looked like the perfect family. Smiling faces. Suburban dreams. A baby on the way. But behind closed doors, silence was building. And in the early hours of one August morning, it exploded into one of the most disturbing crimes in American history. I didn't just lose control. I murdered everything I claimed to love. This is my confession. Not for sympathy. Not for redemption. But so you never mistake a smile for peace again. This is Shadows Beneath the Surface, the story of how a man became a monster and why no one saw it coming. Welcome to the Murder Tape Chronicles audiobook. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you Shadows Beneath the Surface, a Colorado family tragedy. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1. Something's off, but no one notices. They say hindsight is 20/20, but what they don't tell you is how damn loud it gets in the rearview. Every laugh, every forced smile, every I love you, echoed back at me like a gunshot I didn't hear go off. And when you've already put the safety on your soul and handed someone else the trigger, you don't realize it's over until the blood's already drying. Let me back up. It was the summer of 2018, and the sun in Frederick, Colorado, was hot as hell, but still managed to feel cold to me. Like the sky was mocking me. How could the world keep turning, bright and blue and blinding, when inside I was unraveling, one thread at a time? From the outside, our life was beautiful. Picture perfect, even. A well-manicured lawn. Two happy girls with curly hair and unicorn backpacks. A wife who never stopped smiling. A baby on the way. Social media told the story we needed it to. Motivational posts, inspirational quotes, family portraits with captions like "My World." But the truth? That perfect life? It was heavy. It was fucking suffocating. Shauna, God, she was a force. Organized, loud, relentless. The kind of woman who could outplan a hurricane. She ran our life with a calendar in one hand and a phone in the other, juggling the kids, her supplements business, her pregnancy, and me, like I was just one more task to manage. One more box to tick. And I became a ghost in my own home. It didn't happen overnight. At first, I convinced myself I was just tired. Long shifts at the oil site. Stress. No time to breathe. But deep down, I knew it was more than that. I wasn't just tired. I was fucking lost. We used to be in love. I swear we did. There were moments, small ones, blurry now, where we were real. The early days. Young and stupid and full of fire. But fire, when you don't feed it the right way, doesn't just burn out. It turns into smoke. It chokes everything around it. It poisons the air. And I started choking. Every time Shannon looked at me with that fixed smile, every time she posted a photo of us online with some rehearsed caption like, "So blessed to do life with this man," I felt like a liar. Like I was playing a part one never auditioned for, reading from a script I didn't write. Then came the silence. Not hers. Mine. I stopped answering her calls while I was at work. I stopped texting back when she'd send heart emojis or updates about the kids. I even stopped listening when she spoke directly to me. My body present, my mind floating somewhere outside the house, detached like a balloon someone let go of. And then there was her. The other woman. We met by chance or fate or some cruel twist of the universe. She was soft-spoken. Gentle. No baggage. No high expectations. She didn't ask about diaper brands or doctor's appointments or what time to leave for dance practice. She asked about me, the me buried under layers of husband, father, provider, failure. I felt seen again, alive. I didn't cheat, not at first. I told myself that, but that was the first lie. The second was that it didn't mean anything. The third was that it would never go further. Lies stack quietly, like bricks. And before you realize it, you've built a wall so high, you can't even see the truth anymore. At home, Shauna noticed. Of course she did. She asked questions I dodged. She pushed buttons I tried to ignore. And the guilt, God, the guilt, it twisted inside me, but not in the way you'd think. It didn't make me feel remorse. It made me feel trapped. That house, our home, started to feel like a coffin. Every room another reminder of the life I no longer wanted, but couldn't walk away from. The girl's drawings on the fridge. The baby monitor on the nightstand. The pregnancy app on Shanann's phone that counted down the days like some sick joke. And yet no one knew. My coworkers thought I was quiet, sure, but steady. My parents said I seemed distracted. Shanann's friends thought maybe we were just going through a rough patch. No one looked close enough to see the rot underneath the paint. But I knew I was slipping. And the worst part, I didn't want to stop. At night, I'd lie awake next to Sean and while she slept, hand resting on her swollen belly. I'd stare at the ceiling, listening to the rhythm of her breathing and the creaks of the old HVAC system, and wonder what it would feel like to just disappear. Not run away. Not vanish. Just erase it all. Wipe the slate clean. Start over. Somewhere along the way, that became my obsession. My comfort. I wasn't dreaming of a better marriage. I was fantasizing about freedom. About waking up without expectation, without pressure, without the weight of four lives hanging from my shoulders. But fantasies are dangerous things. They don't stay inside forever. Eventually, they find a way out. And in August of 2018, mine did. But not in the way I imagined. Chapter 2. Three smiles, one lie. There's a moment, right before everything goes to hell, where time slows down. It doesn't stop. That's a lie people tell to make trauma sound poetic. No. Time slows, stretches like gum pulled between fingers. And in that moment, you can hear things you normally wouldn't. The hum of a refrigerator, the distant bark of a dog, the static buzz in your ears that might be guilt, or maybe adrenaline. I remember that moment clear as day. It was early Monday morning, August 13th, 2018. The world outside was still asleep. But I was awake. Wired. Tense. Like my bones were too tight for my skin. Shannon had just gotten home from a business trip. One of those health and wellness retreats for her supplement company. She had flown in from Arizona late, real late. I'd watched the doorbell footage back since then. She walked in at exactly 1:48 a.m. I didn't hear her at first, but when the garage door opened, I felt that familiar pit in my stomach. A silent thud of dread. She came into the bedroom quietly. She thought I was asleep. I wasn't. I never really slept anymore. She put her suitcase down with a soft thunk, tiptoed to the bathroom. I watched her in the dark, her silhouette barely illuminated by the hallway light. She moved slowly, like she was trying not to wake the sleeping giant. The irony, of course, is that I was already awake. Always awake. She slid into bed beside me and whispered, "Hey." I didn't answer. Just pretended to shift in my sleep. And for a few moments, there was quiet. No arguing. No questions. Just two people, breathing next to each other, lying to themselves about everything they were about to lose. By morning, the temperature in the house had changed. Not literally, but emotionally. You could feel it like static. Like the walls were watching. The girls were up early. Always were. Bella padded into the bedroom first, dragging her favorite blanket behind her. Celeste followed, bouncing with her usual chaotic energy. Shannon opened her eyes and smiled at them like nothing was wrong. Like the world wasn't tilting. "Come give mommy a hug," she said, arms wide. They rushed to her, giggling, climbing into bed. It was a beautiful moment. It was also my breaking point. I watched the three of them tangled together, all laughter and light. And I felt distant, like I was watching a memory that didn't belong to me anymore. I got up, went downstairs, stared out the kitchen window, watching the sun rise over the quiet suburb. My coffee sat untouched. My hands trembled slightly, not from nerves, but from the knowledge that today, this day, was the day I'd decided to erase it all. Shannon came down about 30 minutes later. The girls were still upstairs, finishing breakfast. She asked me if we could talk. There it was. The moment. I nodded and followed her to the living room. She sat on the edge of the couch, arms folded, one knee bouncing nervously. Her eyes were sharp, scanning me like she already knew the truth, but needed to hear it from my mouth. "I know about her," she said. I didn't flinch. I saw the charges on the card. The hotel. The meals. "You've been fucking her, haven't you?" I stayed quiet. What was I supposed to say? Deny it? Pretend I wasn't already mentally moved in with another woman? "Do you love her?" she asked next. And this time I answered. "I don't know." She recoiled like I'd slapped her. Tears welled up, but she blinked them away. "I gave you everything," she whispered. "I carried your children. I fought for us. And you. I didn't ask you to," I said, sharper than I meant to. Silence. That's when it started. The spiral. She stood up, voice rising. "You're a coward. You want to run away with some whore and leave me with three kids? You think I won't ruin you in court? You think I won't take them and disappear?" I told her to calm down. She wouldn't. She kept coming, words like bullets, fast and pointed. Something in me snapped. I don't even remember standing up. One second I was begging her to stop. The next, I was on top of her. my hands around her neck, her eyes wide, her legs kicking, her voice gone. Time slowed again. I remember the exact second her body went limp, the way her head tilted, the final push of air from her lungs like a sigh of betrayal. I held on longer than I needed to, maybe because I knew once I let go, there was no undoing it. And then, Daddy, Bella, her voice shattered everything. She was standing at the edge of the living room, clutching the staircase railing. Why is Mommy on the floor? I froze. Celeste peeked from behind her sister, her thumb in her mouth, wide-eyed, confused. I opened my mouth but said nothing. Because what the fuck do you say to your kids when they've just seen you kill their mother? I stood, still panting, still trembling. Go to your room, I said. They didn't move. Now, I shouted. They ran upstairs, footsteps thudding like war drums. I looked down at Sean Anne, dead, pregnant, gone. And I knew, deep in my rotting core, that the lie I'd been living was no longer sustainable. That everything from this point on wasn't about salvaging anything. It was about control. Survival. Keeping the facade alive long enough to figure out what the hell to do next. But nothing could have prepared me for what came next. The part where I'd stare into the eyes of my daughters, and destroy them too. But that comes later. Right now. Right then. I was still trying to convince myself that maybe, just maybe, this wasn't real. That if I scrubbed hard enough, if I cleaned fast enough, I could erase what I had done. Spoiler alert, you can't. Blood doesn't wash away. Not really. It just hides in the cracks, waiting to surface when you least expect it. Chapter 3. Oily Graves and Hollow Lies. Have you ever driven a truck with two kids in the back seat and a dead woman at your feet? No. Then you don't know silence. Not the silence of peace. Not the kind that brings calm. I'm talking about the kind of silence that screams in your ears. That wraps around your throat like a noose you tied yourself. That digs in behind your eyes and whispers, "There's no turning back." That was the silence I drove through. Just after 5 a.m., the sky was still bleeding darkness. The sun hadn't risen yet. The neighborhood was asleep, unaware of the horror that had already unfolded inside the two-story house on Saratoga Trail. The girls were strapped in behind me, Bella and Celeste, small, tired, confused. Bella kept asking, "Where's Mommy?" Celeste sucked her thumb and clutched her blanket like it was a shield against the truth. I didn't answer. I couldn't. Seanan was at my feet, her body wrapped tightly in the white sheet from our bed. The sheet that still smelled like lavender fabric softener. Her long hair, now matted. Her limbs twisted. Her belly, still carrying our unborn son. Nico, a name we had chosen and painted on the nursery wall. I turned up the radio just loud enough to drown out the thoughts trying to claw their way into my head. But it didn't work. They were too loud. The drive to the oil site was about 45 minutes. I knew every turn, every pothole. I'd driven it hundreds of times for work, but this time, my hands were numb on the wheel. My chest was tight. My stomach hollowed out like someone had scooped it clean with a spoon. There was no plan. Let me say that again. There was no plan. People think monsters are masterminds. That killers sketch out their crimes like blueprints. But the truth is much messier. I didn't have a master plan. I didn't even have a damn shovel in the back. I just had desperation and death. As the site came into view, those massive oil tanks rising like black sentinels in the pre-dawn haze, I felt a wave of nausea wash over me. But I kept driving. Because what the hell else was I supposed to do? Stop. Call someone? Tell the police? Confess? No. I had crossed the point of no return the second my hands closed around Shanann's throat. And now, it was about finishing what I started. I parked near the tanks. Killed the engine. The silence returned, heavier this time. I got out. Opened the back. Bella looked up at me with those big brown eyes. The same ones she inherited from her mother. "Where's Mommy?" I said she was sleeping. I fucking said she was sleeping. Celeste giggled, like this was a game. She pointed toward the field. "Is Mommy hiding?" "No, baby. She wasn't hiding. She was dead." I pulled Shanann's body from the floor of the truck. The sheet slipped slightly, revealing part of her arm. I quickly tucked it back in and carried her through the weeds and dirt. The morning air was cool, but I was sweating through my shirt. Every step felt like dragging 1,000 pounds through cement. I dropped her in a shallow pit I had helped dig weeks earlier for work. It wasn't meant to be a grave, but it would become one. I didn't even look at her face. Couldn't. Didn't deserve to. I covered her with dirt using my hands, shoveling and scraping like an animal, like I was trying to bury my own guilt before it could grow. And then, I turned back to the truck. That's when it happened. Bella said, "Daddy?" I turned, tears in her eyes. "You're not gonna hurt us, right?" I froze. In that moment, everything inside me shattered. I wanted to scream, to run, to claw my own skin off. But instead, I nodded. "No, baby," I lied. "Of course not." I lifted Celeste out first. She had no idea what was happening. She giggled again as I carried her across the dirt. I told her to close her eyes. I said it was a surprise. I smothered her with the same blanket she brought everywhere. The one with the butterflies. The one she wouldn't sleep without. Her body squirmed. Fought. Her tiny fists beat against my chest. And then nothing. Stillness. I laid her down beside one of the oil tanks. I opened the hatch. The smell hit me, crude and chemical and cold. I shoved her body into the hatch, barely big enough for her frame. Then I turned to Bella. She was crying now, sobbing. "Where's Cece?" I said she was okay, that she went to sleep. Bella backed away, trying to run, but her legs were too short. I caught her, held her. She begged me. "Daddy, no." Those words haunt me. They are the echo of everything I lost, everything I destroyed, everything I'll never deserve to forget. I did it anyway. I used the same blanket. She fought harder than her sister. Stronger. Longer. She knew. She knew what I was doing. She looked me in the eye as I stole the life out of her body. And that broke something inside me that will never be fixed. I carried her to the second tank, opened the hatch, slid her in. She got stuck. Her body didn't fit easily. I had to shove her harder. I had to bend her. God. I closed the hatches, staggered back, dropped to my knees in the dirt, my head spinning, bile rising in my throat. I had done it. I had killed them all. 3 lives extinguished. 1 unborn, never even given a chance to cry. All for what? To be free? To start over? There was no freedom here. Only silence. And guilt. And oil-soaked ghosts that would never, ever let me rest. I cleaned up as best I could. Wiped the truck. Changed my shirt. Texted her friends. Made it look like Shannon had never come home. I even called the school to let them know the girls wouldn't be in. Because murder doesn't stop the calendar. And evil still wears a fucking name badge. I went home. Stood in the kitchen. Washed my hands. Ate cold eggs. And waited for the world to notice what was missing. But I already knew. What was missing could never be brought back. Because I was the one who took it. With my own goddamn hands. Chapter 4. The House of Cameras. They say the worst part of doing something unforgivable is the guilt. That's bullshit. The worst part is pretending like you didn't. It's standing in your living room, wiping down countertops with your wife's blood still under your fingernails. It's sipping coffee like you didn't just kill your entire fucking family. It's looking into your neighbor's eyes and pretending to be concerned when you know damn well there's nothing left to be concerned about. I woke up that morning, or whatever you'd call the hours after I buried my soul in the dirt, and stared at the walls of our house like I'd never seen them before. The beige paint, the white trim, the family portraits nailed perfectly along the hallway, the girls' school photos, a shot of me and Shannon on our wedding day, her in white, me in black, both smiling like we knew what love was. I stared at that photo for what felt like hours. Then I turned it face down. That house had become a stage. I was just an actor now. One playing the role of worried husband with a shaky voice and shallow eyes. I started early, laid the groundwork. I texted Shanann's friend Nicole around 7:40 a.m. said I hadn't heard from her. That she missed her OB appointment. That I was worried. Worried. Jesus. The words slid out of my mouth like syrup. Thick. Sweet. Sticky with manipulation. Nicole wasn't buying it. She texted me back fast, frantic. She'd dropped Shannon off last night. She said she was going to stop by. Said something felt off. I played dumb. Oh, that's weird. Yeah, I'm worried too. Every lie felt like a second skin now. Comfortable. Custom fitted. But inside, my heart thudded against my ribs like it wanted out. Like it was trying to escape the body of a man it no longer recognized. Nicole came by with her son around lunchtime. I stalled her. Said maybe Shannon went out. Maybe she needed space. I gave her every excuse I could think of while silently screaming for time to think, to clean, to control the chaos swirling behind every corner of our home. But she wasn't backing down. When the front door didn't open and Shanann's car was still in the garage, she called the police. That's when everything changed. The cops came faster than I expected. Two officers. Calm. Friendly. Curious. Not accusatory, yet. They asked questions. Basic ones. When did you last see your wife? This morning. Did you two fight? No. Do you know where she might have gone? No idea. She's been stressed. Maybe she just needed to get away. And then came the kicker. Mind if we take a look around? I hesitated. Just for a second. Just long enough to make a dent. Then I nodded and stepped aside. They walked through the kitchen first. Then the living room. Upstairs. One of them commented on how clean everything looked. Too clean, maybe. In the bedroom, they found her suitcase. Still packed. Her purse. Her phone. Her keys. Nothing was taken. Nothing was missing. Except her. They asked if we had a security system. I said yes. They asked to see it. I hesitated again. Another dent. But what choice did I have? I played the footage. Showed them the garage door opening. Shanann walking inside at 1:48 a.m. Nothing else. They asked if there were cameras inside. I said no. Lie. There were cameras. Not all connected. Not all working. But some. And neighbors had cameras too. That's what did it. The guy next door invited them in to view his surveillance footage. I walked over with them, my hands in my pockets, my jaw tight. He queued up the video from early that morning. I watched myself, blurry and pixelated, backing my truck into the driveway at 5:17 a.m. I loaded something. They couldn't tell what. Neither could I, in that moment. Not objectively. Not from the screen. But I knew. I fucking knew. They watched me pull away. Then nothing. No footage of Shanann leaving. No kids. No movement from the front door. Nothing. Just me. Alone. Loading my secrets into a truck bed and driving them into the dark. That was when I felt it, the shift. The quiet click of suspicion turning into certainty. I tried to talk my way through it. Oh yeah, I had to move tools for work. I always back into load up. But I could feel it. The eyes on me. The sideways glances. The way the cop's hand hovered just slightly over his notepad, like he already knew what he was going to write next. I was losing control. So I leaned into the role. Pressed my palms to my eyes. Forced a few dry sobs. My wife, she wouldn't leave the girls like this. I just want them home. More lies. More dents. Later that night, I did an interview on the local news. Looking back, I don't know what the hell I was thinking. Maybe I believed I could still lie my way through it. Maybe I thought I looked sad enough. Desperate enough. Innocent enough. I stood on the porch and begged for her return. I looked into the camera and said, Shanann, if you're out there, please come home. Me and the girls. Me and the girls. God, the girls were already gone. Their bodies dissolving in crude oil as I pretended to mourn. People online noticed it immediately. They called it out in real time. The lack of tears. The stiff body language. The wrong words. The wrong pauses. The wrong everything. The world turned into an investigation machine. Reddit threads. Facebook groups. YouTube psych analysts dissecting every blink, every breath. They saw through me faster than I ever imagined. Even my own father, when he finally flew in to help, looked at me with eyes that said something isn't right. And when the police asked me to come in for more questioning, I said yes. Because what else could I do? The walls were closing in. The house was no longer a home. It was a crime scene wrapped in silence and lies. Every creak in the floorboards was a whisper. Every light fixture felt like a spotlight. I knew it was only a matter of time. And still I tried. One last time, I tried to talk my way out. But the thing about lies is, eventually they rot. And when they rot, they stink. No matter how good of an actor you are, you can't scrub that smell off your skin. It seeps in. It lingers. And when the truth knocks, it knocks hard. And loud. Chapter 5. The mirror that won't shatter. Prisons aren't made of concrete and steel. They're made of memories. Of echoes. Of moments you can't take back. People think my punishment started when the judge said, life without the possibility of parole. That's not true. My punishment started long before the cell door clanged shut. It started the second I looked into Bella's eyes and did what no father should ever be capable of doing. You can't build a cage big enough to contain the weight of that kind of sin. It lives inside you. Gnaws at you. And when it whispers, it uses the voice of your child. I remember the room where it all finally crumbled. It was cold, artificial cold, like the kind hospitals or funeral homes have. The interrogation room was plain, blank, no windows, just four walls and a table that felt more like an altar than a surface. A place where I was supposed to sacrifice what was left of myself. The detective sat across from me, straight-faced, patient, but they weren't asking anymore. They were waiting. They knew. Everyone knew. And I was tired. So fucking tired of pretending. The lies had stacked so high I couldn't breathe under them anymore. There was no more room to run. No exit door. No reset button. So I told them, piece by piece, how I killed Sean in the bedroom. How the girls saw. How I drove them out to the oil site. How I murdered them too. How I buried their mother in a shallow grave and stuffed my daughters, into tanks of crude oil like garbage. I said it all. Deadpan. Flat. Robotic. Because the only thing worse than the guilt was reliving it out loud. They didn't yell. They didn't scream. They just sat there. Quiet. Heavy. As if the air itself refused to carry the weight of my words. My dad was there, too. They brought him in before the confession, hoping it would shake something loose. And it did. When I saw his face, his disappointment, his confusion, his pain, it was like watching the foundation of a house collapse. I wasn't just a murderer in that moment. I was a son who had taken everything his father had ever taught him and burned it to the ground. The trial never happened. No jury. No dramatics. I pled guilty to every charge. Not because I found redemption. Don't make that mistake. But because there was nothing left to protect. No legacy. No future. No name worth saving. I stood in that courtroom as the judge read off the sentence. 5 life terms, no parole, stacked on top of each other like bricks in a tomb. And I just nodded. Because what else do you do when the rest of your life has been carved into a number? I remember looking back at Shanann's family. Her father couldn't even meet my eyes. Her mother was weeping into a handkerchief. And her brother, God, the hate in his face, it should have burned through me. I wanted it to. I deserved it. But I felt nothing. Because by then, I had already become a ghost. The news spread like fire. The family man turned family annihilator. They gave me names online. Monster, sociopath, demon. I stopped correcting them. Because they weren't wrong. Social media ripped me apart. Armchair experts diagnosed me from blurry footage and transcript leaks. YouTubers ran frame-by-frame analyses of my body language. Reddit threads dissected my every movement. They turned my life into a meme, a documentary, a podcast. American Murder, The Family Next Door, they called it. Catchy. Marketable. I watched pieces of myself be sold to strangers for clicks and outrage. They asked over and over again why. And I don't have an answer that makes any fucking sense. Not to them. Not to me. It wasn't rage. It wasn't sudden. It was slow. Poisonous. A buildup of cowardice and selfishness and desperation, layered so thinly over the years that by the time it reached the surface, I didn't even recognize myself anymore. That's the part they don't show in the documentaries, the erosion. The tiny, invisible ways a person dies long before they kill. I didn't wake up one day and decide to murder my family. I just stopped trying to love them. And by the time I realized that, it was too late. Now, I live in a concrete box. No windows. 1 hour outside. 23 in. I count the steps it takes to walk from the toilet to the wall. 17. I count the bricks in the floor. 89. I count the memories I wish I could erase. Too many. I'm not allowed photographs. But I still see their faces. Bella, with her cautious eyes and quiet wisdom. Celeste, always laughing, always moving. Shanann, fierce and flawed and fearless. And Nico, my son, who never got the chance to breathe. I talk to them at night. Not out loud, but in my head. I say I'm sorry. Every. Fucking. Night. But they don't answer. And they never will. I used to believe in God. Not anymore. Because if there is a hell, I'm already living in it. Not because of the prison or the isolation or the name they branded me with, but because I remember. I remember everything. And there's no bleach strong enough to scrub out what I see when I close my eyes. I don't expect forgiveness. Not from the world. Not from their family. Not even from myself. But I do believe in truth. And this story you've just heard, is mine. Ugly. Honest. Final. I tell it not because I want you to understand me. But because I want you to never become me. If you're lost, talk. If you're drowning, reach. If you're angry, fucking scream before it boils into something irreversible. Because once it's done, once blood has been spilled, Once you cross that invisible line, you don't get to come back. You don't get to cry and be comforted. You don't get to rebuild. You only get silence. And if you're lucky, maybe someday, a mirror that finally shatters.